Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll be joined by Joan Walsh from The Nation. She's going to talk to us about the elite fetish for civility, as a lot of people have hit the fainting couches this week over some peaceful protests outside the homes of the Supreme Court's robe tyrants, you know, as they get ready to overturn Roe. By the way, there's no other way of holding these people responsibility for their judicial activism from the bench. It's the closest they'll ever get to democratic accountability. But I mean, these were, again, peaceful protests. But first, I want to go over some news you may have missed about America's police. Some news that might help explain why we spend more on policing than any other country. By far, we spend actually more than many countries spend on their entire defense budgets, and have pretty shitty outcomes in terms of crime prevention and also upholding our rights, our civil rights. It's easy to forget that that's part of the cop's job as well. In California, the legislature passed a statewide audit of the practices of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, the police departments of San Jose, San Bernardino, and Stockton. Also the State Department of Corrections. This is a broad cross-section of California law enforcement. And according to Rolling Stone, and I quote, it uncovered significant evidence of racial bias among officers, some of whom are found to openly support extremist groups like the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and neo-Confederate organizations. California, famously a southern state. According to the report, and I quote again, the problems begin with lax recruiting that often fails to screen new hires and often neglects to ask references whether prospective hires have demonstrated discriminatory behavior. So that's happening out in California. Speaking of police audits, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights released the results of its own two-year investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department last week, or maybe it was the week before. Among the findings of that report, as you might expect at this point, was that, and here I'm quoting Dina Winter of the Minnesota Reformer, the Minneapolis Police Department, quote, maintains a culture where MPD officers consistently use racist, misogynistic, and disrespectful language and are rarely held accountable. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights found in 24% of use of force files, there is evidence in the file that contradicts or disputes the information that an officer recorded in their use of force report. They found that 78% of all searches during traffic stops were of Black people, even though Black folks are 19% of the population. Also, and this one is crazy, I'm going to quote, prosecutors noted that it can be difficult to rely on MPD officers' body-worn camera video in court because of how disrespectful and offensive MPD officers are to criminal suspects, witnesses, and bystanders. I laugh just so that I can keep from crying, of course. So just let that one sink in. They have a difficulty. Prosecutors have difficulty using the body camera footage because these cops are so disrespectful and offensive to not only the suspects, but just everybody around. Also, MPD officers, according to the report, quote, used covert or fake social media accounts to surveil and engage Black individuals, Black organizations, and elected officials. And this surveillance was unrelated to criminal activity and without a public safety objective. Speaking of racist cops, a local NBC affiliate down in North Carolina reports, and I quote, nearly 2 years have passed since three Wilmington police officers were captured by a malfunctioning dashboard camera, making racist and offensive comments that ultimately led to their termination. Okay, that's not a big story. It happens. But one of them is appealing his termination by arguing that it violated his religious liberties, which is just like an ice cream sundae of wingnuttery, right? According to the report, this cop says the racist conversation, and then another racist conversation that was later discovered, so not just one racist comment, weren't racist at all, and I quote now from this guy's appeal letter, because The Holy Bible teaches that no one should bow down before another human being or idol and worship them. This conversation was about the Black Lives Matter protesters and was not racially motivated, but expressed my personal opinions based on my religious beliefs. So there you go. His racism was not racist at all. It's just expressing his religious beliefs. Who can really object to that? They say there's only a few bad apples in the barrel of American policing. But the problem is one of the problems is it's very hard to fire cops. Very hard to fire cops. And then keep them fired. There was an interesting story on, was it Radio Lab or This American Life, one of those, about this this cop who had a pattern of racial antagonism and bullying, and the police chief, his own police chief, was like, this guy's a bad cop and he's dangerous and he's a racist, and he really could not fire him. He had to kind of buy him off by commissioning a positive report about a complaint and letting him retire early. That was the only way he could get rid of this cop. And they said in the story, this is pretty common, that they have to buy off cops because police unions have so much power. So what happens if, you know, you only have a couple of bad apples in a barrel, but you can't get rid of them? What happens to all the other apples in the barrel? Anyway, speaking of a few bad apples, two cops in New Jersey reported a fellow officer, a guy named Christopher Forcenito, for racial profiling, among other stuff. According to NewJersey.com, the cop first pulled over a Black man for speeding and gave him a ticket, right? And then, and here I quote the report, the same morning, Forcenito stopped a white man driving 65 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone and let him go with just a verbal warning. Forcenito allegedly told the other cops that, and again, I quote, he did not issue a speeding ticket to the white man because the driver was a nice guy. So one of the reporting police, one of the cops that reported this dude, was a supervisor, and he ordered Forcenito to write a report and say why he chose not to issue a summons for, quote, such an egregious traffic violation. And this cop just refused to write the report. So they filed, these two cops then filed complaints against this cop for insubordination and racially influenced profiling. And I don't know if you've followed a lot of stories like this, but if you do, you might sense where this one is going. According to the two cops that reported this guy, according to their lawsuit, less than 2 weeks later, one of them was notified that she was the target of an internal affairs investigation in the Forcenito matter. So internal affairs, she files a report. She says this guy is a racist and also insubordinate. He refused to follow my orders, and internal affairs ends up investigating her. Within a year, both of them were charged with 10 violations of departmental rules, regulations, and policies, and both were suspended from their jobs without pay for 45 days. Just a few bad apples. And in other police news, Reuters reports that a police instructor who has taught 560 police officers in recent years has joined one extremist group and supported other far-right movements. Other police trainers have, quote, echoed QAnon and other fringe conspiracy theories on social media. One trainer, quote, has voiced the belief that Democrats are pedophiles, called reports of violence during the U.S. Capitol riots fake news, and declared the 2020 election illegitimate, commenting, election fraud is the real pandemic. You know, training is it's just an issue we don't talk enough about for a couple of reasons, one of which is that folks on the left think that it distracts from the larger problem of racially biased policing. But the reality is that there are no national standards for training the police. And so you get a lot of, from agency to agency, you can have a whole different training regime. And by the way, our police all get less training than police in most wealthy, highly developed countries. I wrote about a survey a couple of years ago. This think tank called the Police Executive Research Forum. They study policing issues, and they did a survey of 280 police departments, and they found that the American cops are given a lot of training in using violence and very little guidance in how to avoid using violence. So they found that the median police recruit in the United States gets 129 hours of instruction on using his or her gun, baton, a pepper spray, and taser. That same median cadet will then get another 24 hours of scenario-based training where they learn things like when to shoot or when to hold fire. They also end up getting 48 hours of instruction on use of force policies. And then that same future cop will only get 8 hours of training in conflict de-escalation. Then there's in-service training after they graduate from the academy and become a cop. A total of 59% of a cop's time is spent, the continuing in-service training time is spent on using weapons. And that's four times as much time that they get with training devoted to de-escalation and crisis intervention. So that's where we are in this country. We have a huge problem, not only with bad cops that can't be fired, and not only with cops who harbor like racial bias, we also have a massive problem with politicized cops and politicized police trainers, right? And cops who embrace right-wing propaganda about Antifa or Black Lives Matter protesters or whatever, and who allow those beliefs to influence their work as policemen. And on that decidedly happy note, let's take a quick break and then come right back with Joan Walsh. Stay tuned. This road is going to take us back now. You look so Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Joan Walsh. Joan is the nation's national affairs correspondent. She's the author of What's the Matter with White People, which is should be like a 10-volume set, I think. And she's also the producer of The Sit-In, which you can stream on Peacock TV. Joan Walsh, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
I'm so glad to be with you.
You know, I wish you were a happier time. I wish it were. It's been a maddening couple of weeks since Politico published a draft of an opinion written by Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito that would overturn Roe v. Wade and also Casey v. Planned Parenthood and some other super precedents and pave the way for red states to outlaw abortion. You have a piece up at The Nation. It's titled Fuck Civility, and it's related to the right's latest effort to distract from the substance of that ruling. Joan, that title seems to be somewhat lacking in civility, I have to tell you.
Well, but you did not share that I actually put in some little characters in the middle so yes. That it doesn't actually say fuck civility, because using fuck in a headline would violate The Nation's civility terms.
It's also bad for search engine optimization.
It kind of is, yeah. I mean, or maybe not. I mean, maybe now, like, people are searching for fuck civility, but
But yeah, I search for that every day.
I do too.
I'm always looking for that. Yeah, a little.
Absolutely. but so it was a little bit cleaned up, but it did rocket to the top of the nation's headlines, which I assumed it would. And yeah, you know, I mean, Josh, I'm like done with civility. I'm so anti-violence. I am anti-property destruction. I really think that, you know, those things, for one, you know, violence is bad, and property destruction, people like defend it, but I've been in situations or known of situations where people got killed just because of plain old property destruction. You didn't know they were there, but they were there, so now they're dead. So I'm very civil. And as I say in the piece, I'm not even positive that I would have joined the protests outside the various justices' houses. But now, as I've written about it more and gotten reaction, I'm like, oh, hell yeah, I would definitely be out there. Invite me down for the next one. And I just think the Democrats are they're just scared of their shadows. And they, you know, they really don't like this stuff. And I am horrified by that, because we're not going to get any of our rights back if we don't all go out and, you know, make some noise.
Yeah, that's right. And for listeners who haven't been paying attention to this whole debate, there were some peaceful protesters outside of the homes of a couple of Supreme Court justices, Brett Kavanaugh, Sam Alito. The neighbors were giving out cookies in some places, I think outside of Brett Kavanaugh's house. It was not violent. People were staying on the sidewalks. It was a protest. And
they are our sidewalks. I mean, I'm sorry. I just feel like I have to say that.
Yeah, no, they were not on their properties themselves, according to reports. There was just on their. And then Maine Senator Susan Collins called the police because people wrote on the sidewalk with chalked the sidewalk, a message about abortion rights. And
a message that said, please pass.
It's so civil. I mean, it's so civil. You're going to even say please and thank you. And this has led to this elite freak out this week. Joan writes, and I quote, on Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Biden abhors violence, threats, or vandalism, and that judges must be able to do their jobs without concern for their personal safety. The same day, Senate Democrats joined Republicans in passing a bill by unanimous consent to hike security for justices and their families. Joan quotes a couple of Democratic senators condemning threats. So Chris Coons said, we must take threats that come from extremes on both sides of the political spectrum seriously. Very both sides kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. We talk about partisan asymmetries a lot on the show because they're so stark and so impactful. And this seems like a big one. Like the Democrats are literally amplifying bad faith talking points cooked up by the right. And what do Republicans do when their base commits acts of like violence or harassment, right? They engage in whataboutism. What about Antifa, they say.
Well, and they also engage in the violence. Some of them engage in the violence too, we must note. But right, I mean, it's so insane. They could have said it was only Antifa. I mean, I'm glad they didn't say that. Yeah. But the fact that they just bowed down and acted as though, oh yes, there really were threats. There were no threats. I mean, you know, if you looked at those lovely people on the sidewalks, A, they were on the sidewalks, and B, they weren't really that, they weren't threatening at all. And, you know, Susan Collins, I mean, I'm probably gonna take the train to Maine. I have a really close friend up there, Josh. I think you know her, and I miss her a lot. So I think I should just go up there but also bring a lot of chalk and write Susan some notes on.
Yeah, absolutely. You should write your next column on the sidewalk in front of our house.
That's a great idea. I'm not sure that my editors would appreciate that because they would have to figure out whatever, you know, maybe.
Get a Nation intern to go up there with you and copyright it.
Yeah. And yeah, just take pictures or whatever.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I mean, let's dig into why this is. Is this just because Democrats fear the right's sprawling media networks, or is something else going on here?
You know, I think it's something else, and I'm actually not sure I know what it is. You know, they know that Fox is going to depict them as, you know, vandalists, Antifa supporters, baby killers, whatever they do. So I don't really think it's that. I think it is. I mean, it's actually kind of sad to me because I think I used to be like this, you know, 20 years ago or something, where you're just like, can you, sorry.
It's okay. It's all right.
We'll just cut that out.
I'll leave it in. I don't even care anymore. I really don't.
Yeah, really?
You know, it used to be, I always tell people like it used to be the case that when there's a noise in the background, I'd be like, oh no, we got to cut this out. We'll stop it. But then the pandemic hit and everybody, you know, if you turn on CNN or whatever, people's cats and children are coming through. And so I don't care anymore.
Well, it's Amy Loughran. So I can't do that. And also my dog just jumped out of bed. So, you know,
anyway. You got a lot going on. I've got two dogs here that I've been fortunate are not making noise yet, but it could happen.
It could happen. And we would love it. Yeah. Obviously, both of us. I'm sorry, what were we saying?
So I'm just talking about like why Democrats have this squeamishness. I'm going to ask it a related question, same question in a different way. You have Democrats are saying, well, you know, we're going to have to run on this. We're going to have to run on abortion. That's the way to protect abortion rights. Elect more pro-choice Democrats. And they're saying, well, this is something maybe we can turn around the fairly bleak outcome for the midterms here. We have an opportunity. I think that Democrats would have an opportunity to do to make gains on this issue, except they seem squeamish about it and they seem unwilling to go after Republicans on an issue where, frankly, they have public opinion on their side. There's a squeamishness, and it tends to always come up when you deal with social issues, you know, and you know, we call it culture war. And then they're like, oh no, it's culture war. We're going to get beat here.
Right. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that they're voting on it today. It's going to lose. Frickin' Joe Manchin, you know, just the worst person in the world, said he will vote again. He'll be the only Democrat to vote against it. I want to say, I always like to hail some progress. Bob Casey, whose father was the Casey in Planned Parenthood versus Casey back in the early 90s, that, you know, important case. Bob Casey is supporting the codification of Roe v. Wade. So progress is possible. Joe Manchin is not, and progress is not possible in West Virginia, but we're going to have to take a few other Senate seats to make progress possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they're doing, a lot of people think that's a stupid thing to do, but I actually think anytime you just get them out there, you vote, you get the assholes voting against, you know, what we want, what is good, that's a good thing. I am not sure how it plays in November. I am somebody who has many times said that these kinds of things help Democrats, and I kind of think it will, but I'm just not sure. I think that our politics right now is so skewed and tortured and hard to understand that I can't say, oh, of course, people, you know, even Republicans support most of Roe. this is going to be a bloodbath for them. I don't know. I just, you know, I want that to be true. I will, you know, as we see more polling, as it gets closer to November, and if it is true, I will write about it. But right now I am kind of paralyzed because I'm just not sure.
I think the way that I see this is that, you know, you need to create the headwinds that you want to see, or the tailwinds you want to see. And what I'm not seeing from Democrats is a real forceful effort to pin this to Republicans' extremism, a Republican court packing. I don't know how many Americans know that there's a 6-3 ultra right wing supermajority in the Supreme Court.
Right.
You know, you need to come out and say it to make it have an impact on the midterms or anything else. And I'll tell you something else. I think there was a very consequential book that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas Frank. And it was a really stupid thesis if you think back on it, right?
I agree.
Like, no, it was very, very influential. And I just feel like Democrats overestimate the degree to which the public is conservative on social issues and the degree to which they need to kind of steer clear of social issues. I think they're wary of engaging with the culture wars, even though they really have very little choice. And we're seeing it with this abortion issue right now.
We're seeing it with this. We're seeing it with, obviously, critical race theory. I am doing a piece that you will have me back on to discuss about the backlash against comprehensive sex education, which, yeah, you know, we all think about as part of, or, you know, mainly the Florida bill, but it's so much more than that. And it is just people, right wingers, acting like, A, you're trying to turn our kids gay. I mean, that is really, really a lot of it. And B, you know, you're trying to take control of what our kids learn about sexuality. And it goes, you know, and as I was writing about it, it goes back into this, you know, it goes back to the 60s. I'm sure it goes back beyond, but that's where I got. And so it's one of those, quote, culture war things that's about women not having autonomy and, you know, LGBTQ people not having identity. They don't exist, you know, that's what they're hoping. And it's all part of this same thing. And you know, I'm trying really hard to make that convincing. So,
yeah. And there's another angle here that I think is just important to note in passing when we see this, like, elite freak out over civility, and the suggestion that peaceful protesters are somehow a threat and have,
right,
you know, are like, that there's people condemning potential violence, like, oh, maybe one of these peaceful protesters can lose their mind, right? Like, who knows? And the point that I want to make about that is that, you know, if we step back a little, we see that the far right has had a near monopoly on serious political violence in this country for a very long time. I'm not talking about punches getting thrown or whatever, because, yes, both sides will, you know, there's kids on both sides who are hotheads. But if you look at people using, like, guns or bombs or motor vehicles to try to maim and kill people, you can find literally like three incidents of such violence coming from the left in the past two decades, whereas it's just common on the far right. And the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security and all these other agencies say that white supremacists and other far right groups pose the greatest terror threat in this country. So, you know, here you have the Democrats, a political party that's supposed to be fighting an increasingly extreme right wing movement. And what they're doing is they're both siding extremist violence. They're obscuring that reality that I just spoke of. So, I mean, it's a big problem.
You know, they passed that unanimous consent, bipartisan let's get the justices and their families more security. And it didn't reflect anything of what we know about violence on the issue, let's just say on the issue of abortion, you know, where there have been, you know, tens of murders and
dozens bombings
of attempted murders and you know, hundreds of arsons. And I mean, we could go on and on,
yes.
But they act like these things are somehow the same. You know, Chris Coons had this, you know, extremes on both sides. I'm sorry, Chris Coons, there are not extremes on both sides. We are using chalk. You know, I was out there Monday night protesting. I might have said F Sam Alito. I'm not sure I did. I know other people did. Maybe I didn't, because I'm, you know, I'm really a very nice lady. But I enjoyed it, whoever said it, I enjoyed it. But it's like, that's not violence, you asshole.
Yeah.
No, and now they've got the huge fences up, so we couldn't have even gone to where we went last Monday night. You know, it's just they're treating us like we are violent people, like we are the, you know, 1/6 insurrectionists.
And meanwhile, and I need to point this out, like, they protest with AR-15s. They do it outside of people's homes.
Yeah.
They've been a whole raft of, you know, armed protesters outside the homes of public health officials across this country. And they also lionize people like Kyle Rittenhouse. So, I mean, again, you have this real, really stark asymmetry here. I would also just point out the very, very obvious, the very obvious irony of, you know, the entire political establishment finding some sort of right to privacy in the penumbra, some sort of penumbra. Just for Supreme Court justice.
There's a penumbra in Montgomery County. It's only in Montgomery County.
Joan, we're going to take a quick break and then come right back. So stay tuned, folks.
It's a matter of time before justice will come.
And we're back. We're speaking with Joan Walsh. Joan, the weaponization of civility isn't something that's new, is it? I mean, there was Gay Teresa Johnson studies the intersection of civility and race at UCLA, right? And last year, or I guess this was 2020, during the peak of the Black Lives Matter protest, she talked about this, how calls for civility have long greeted activists pushing for their rights to be respected. And she cited examples from the civil rights movement in the 60s, to the, you know, Indian rights, gay rights movements, and like ACT UP, fighting for the government to take AIDS seriously, and on and on and on. And she connects that really to colonialism and the God-ordained civilizing mission that justified its exploitation. It's a bit maddening that these kind of long-standing, that there isn't greater awareness of how these very narratives that they're breaking out again and again have this history. You know, you wish that the people had a kind of broader understanding of these things.
You do wish that, but they don't, you know, I mean, about anything. Yeah,
they don't. You're right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
One might wish that, but
there's, you're right. If wishes were fishes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The New Republic has a piece up about how these sweeping laws being considered by many red states would threaten the lives of women with ectopic pregnancies, with pregnancies that are impossible to bring to term anyway, that are not going to end up in a live childbirth. On last week's show, Robin Marty explained how Missouri's existing law, which would snap back into effect, would potentially make it illegal to do in vitro fertilization, right? These laws threaten healthcare providers as well as women with jail time in some cases. And it seems like the Republicans who packed the Supreme Court would like to talk about anything but that. So we have this whole incivility story. And this is the second made up controversy that they've used to distract from the substance of overturning Roe. The first was this kind of obsessive focus on the leak in a town where, you know, leaks are incredibly common. It might be unprecedented for an entire draft of a decision to be leaked. That is the case, but the court has always leaked info to reporters. And I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, if we step back, the right's ability to like call the tune in terms of what we're going to talk about in this country. Or they wanted to talk about leaks, and we all talked about leaks. Not just the conservative media, not just the legacy media, but also the progressive media. Now they want to talk about peace protests outside of justices' homes. And here we are, you and I are right here talking about it.
We're talking about it with a lot of, you know, with a lot of disapproval.
Yes, so. but we're focusing on it, right? As opposed to focusing on, and I'm not blaming us per se, but I'm speaking about the media writ large. Like there is less, you know, there is less talk of the impacts of overturning Roe, for example, than there is about peaceful protesters.
No, I think you're right. I mean, and it's awful. But this, you know, we know you and I live in this world where these are the terms, and we write for the Nation. I write my pieces for the Nation, and you write and you do your podcast, and we have to accept that, you know, we are responding to dealing with these stupid things that emerge. But, you know, I also think I think that the leak, the source of the leak, is really interesting, because I'm not sure it's Ginny Thomas, but people have become the wife of Clarence Thomas. Just, you know, I know our listeners really know what we're talking about, but I just want to add that.
No, definitely.
I'm not sure it's her. I have absolutely no, you know, please don't sue us, because I have no information, no sourcing to say that it is her, but a lot of people are saying it is her. And a lot of other people are saying it's a conservative, because they are trying to hold on. They're trying to corral these five conservatives and, about a decision that is going to be, you know, one of the worst and least popular since Plessy, you know? So I do think that the searching for the leak is interesting. I don't know. We will find out what the actual decision is in the next month or so, and we will deal with it from there. But I do think that this whole, I mean, I hate it. I think it's stupid. But this whole chasing down the leak thing, I really think it's a conservative. So I kind of enjoy it, Josh. Are you
okay? I mean, if we find out that it was a conservative, I mean, it would be, you would expect a lot of people to eat humble pie, right?
They
a
won't.
Lot of
the people
they won't do it, no. Right? they're incapable. Like, their shamelessness is actually a superpower. And just for listeners who haven't been following everything really closely, there is the leak happened. Right-wing outrage, or poutrage, I like to call it, ensued, right? Where they said, oh, this must be some liberal trying to undermine the the legitimacy of the court, blah, blah, blah. And then
they
this,
said it was Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Who has not even joined the court.
That was
not
one of their...
Not even joined the court, yeah. So they're not the, the brightest, you know,
they're not,
bright,
they're
brightest not bulbs in the chandelier yeah. here. So then this, the counter theory is that, no, it was actually a conservative, perhaps a clerk, a staunchly anti-abortion clerk, or Ginny Thomas, who was trying to freeze the majority and make sure that as the wrangling ensued, the usual behind the scenes wrangling, nobody flipped their vote. So yes, there is that. But I just feel like we've come to the point where the tail is wagging the dog when it comes to the conservative media. We had Mike Tomasky on the show last week. He talked a little bit about this, like how 30 or 40 years ago, you had like Walter Cronkite, the mainstream media dominated the, you know, we had partisan media outlets, of course, back then, but the mainstream media dominated the conversation and really directed the national discourse. And the right invested a lot in their alternative media, and they wanted to kind of, you know, be able to influence things, but they've invested so much and built such a sprawling disinformation propaganda network headed by Fox News, the most watched cable station in the country. And now they direct the conversation in a way that is really not great for the rest of us. And it's not great for our democracy to have them deciding what we're going to be outraged about each day.
No, and you know, obviously we don't follow that, but we do know what they're doing. I am actually here to say that Michael Tomasky should be our next Walter Cronkite. I don't know what you and I, Joshua, have to do to make that happen, but I think that should be one of our goals, because you know, he's one of the best.
Tomasky really is one of the best.
Yeah, he really is. He's
He used to have this thing where he would have these pundit accountability moments, which I really respected of him. And he's the only person that I know who does this, who did this, back when he was writing a regular column. He'd be like, okay, here's what I got wrong, and here's why I got it wrong. This is the assumptions that I based that belief on, and I screwed that up. And that takes a lot of courage and honesty to do.
Yeah, I think I did it once or twice, but then I gave it up because it took too much.
it's bad punditry anyway to admit your errors.
No one read it.
You're not supposed to do that. Joan Walsh, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I believe we are out of time, but I really do appreciate it.
Oh my God. Thank you so much.
Let's have you on again soon.
Of course.
I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hull. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
I'm spinning like the undertow, taking you way, way down. My thoughts are colossal, I can see they weigh you down. And I feel my soul is sitting on a dock looking at the endless sea, hoping somehow.